And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live / recorded from New York City, where it's Wednesday after the All-Star break, which means the games start again tomorrow and we can all go back to ignoring our loved ones to watch a ball bounce around a wooden floor and go in some baskets. And I thought a good way to introduce the second half of the season was to have one of my favorite guests and the people's favorite guests on to talk about the players we are most excited to see. Welcome back, Chris Herring of 538. How are you?
I'm good, man. How's it going with you?
I'm good. You are much younger than me, so I have an important question for you. Did you watch any of the coverage of the celebrity game or any of our All-Star Weekend coverage? And did you at any of that coverage see the three young women from TikTok who were heavily featured as part of All-Star Weekend?
I did not see them. I did not see them on television, but I saw the constant tweets and everything else and was just trying to figure out, have I gotten old?
Okay, that's good. Did you know who they were?
No.
Because I never have felt more out in my entire life than when Cassidy Hubbard was like, we got to bring in these people. We got to get a moment with the, and I was like, whoa, I really have lost touch.
I mean, what are they getting paid for? Like, what is that?
No, I'm not judging their livelihood. To be popular at anything takes an enormous amount of work. I just felt like it's over for me.
But like, I mean, is it wrong if I judge the, maybe not the livelihood, but like, I just don't understand what the draw is of like doing what to me looked like a bad dance. And I saw one clip with Nikola Jokic and I'm like, what is this? And Jokic, they looked like they had about as much rhythm as Nikola Jokic. And I know that, I don't know.
Wow.
It just looked.
Chris Herring lighting the TikTok young ladies on fire.
I just didn't understand it. And everybody I saw that, you know, I follow a lot of young people. I try to follow a decent number of fans so that I can kind of get a sense of the pulse of, you know, how fans from a certain fan base feel. And none of them seem to understand it either. They make jokes about it. So I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I don't understand.
All right. That makes me feel better. Because I was watching that, it was the celebrity game was their first appearance, mm-hmm. and then it was clear they were going to be a regular part of All-Star Weekend, and I just thought, I have no idea. Like, usually, it will say actor, and I'm like, oh, I recognize that guy from
sure.
a show I don't watch, but I know is popular, or that's a video game I don't play, but I know, like, vaguely what it is. This, I was like, I have nothing. Like, I have literally no idea, and we're treating them like they're world famous.
I kind of take it as one of those things where if people can laugh at it, and even if it's like laughing at it because it's like, oh, look how silly that is as opposed to it being funny. That's what that felt like to me because it's silly dances, it's silly poses, and it, you know, I guess it kind of fits with some of the Instagram culture and the – did you see the Firefest documentary where there's that one company that does all the branding? And I think they're working on Bloomberg's campaign now, which kind of surprised me. But it's just a certain sense of humor that I don't think I pick up on that people seem to get paid pretty well for. And then more power to them. It's not my sense of humor. It's not something that I understand. Maybe it's not targeted at me, but I didn't understand it.
I'm just going to move on from the Bloomberg reference to basketball now. I thought, okay, so here's what we did to inaugurate the second half of the season, which is not a half, it's like a third. I said, let's pick our five players that we're most interested to watch for the remaining 25 games. Totally open-ended. I even said, you know what, Chris, if you're struggling to come up with five, because we're about to enter garbage basketball for the last 15, 20 games for some of these tanktastic teams, you can pick lineup combinations. You can play around with it. So I don't know your list, and you don't know my list. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start with you. Chris Herring, I don't know if you rank them, but whoever is the first guy you want to mention, player you are most excited to watch for the rest of the season, go.
Okay. I did not rank them, but I'll start here because I kind of feel most strongly about this. We don't take Denver seriously a lot of the time. A lot of people don't take Denver seriously.
I don't. Yeah, don't throw the royal we at me.
I don't want to do it to everybody.
The Denver Nuggets and Nikola Jokic.
Not everybody does it.
Don't you dare.
I picked Jokic as my MVP this year coming into the season. I don't think that's going to happen necessarily.
Hey, by the way, you erased the first month of the season when he would be out of shape and looked like he wanted to just hang out with his horses in Serbia instead of post up. like if you gave him a choice, would you want to score on this undersized center in the post or go back to Serbia and hang with your sources mm-hmm. or with your horses? He would have chose the horses. By the way, not that bad of a choice. Since then, he's been as good as anybody.
He'd be
NBA.
In the race. And what's frustrating a lot of people, and I've seen getting back to a lot of the folks I follow on Twitter, you can't get away from the people that complain and say he's got to drop 20 pounds. And then I think today, you know, maybe his first interview is coming out of the break. He said he's down 20 or 25 from where he started the season. So even when he does that and he's playing at the level that we know he can play at, it kind of fuels the conversation in a direction that, you know, if he had been in great shape or in better shape to start the season, maybe my MVP prediction comes true. And maybe Denver is a little bit closer to maybe winning the one seed out West. Either way, I say all that to say this. I don't know if Denver will get it done. I don't know if they can make it to the conference finals. But I feel like if they do that, even if they don't do it, a big part of what I'm interested to see is what Michael Porter Jr. does.
I told you we would overlap.
On the first one?
But I didn't pick Michael Porter Jr. I cheated and I picked the Denver Nuggets wing supporting cast.
Fair.
And Michael Porter Jr. is the sort of in the background, looming, waiting, rising, will he be ready?
That's why it's interesting to me. You look at it, and I feel like, you know, it was frustrating for the Nuggets fans at the beginning of the season when you are, you know, on some level, maybe not playing as well as you'd hope to right out of the gate, in part because Jokic was still kind of rounding into form. And then he starts to get a chance. And I remember one of those very first games he gets into, he's scoring like crazy, and that's why you wanted him. That's why you took the gamble on his back and everything. So what I'm really intrigued by, there's a couple things. The first thing that jumped out to me, because I've watched, you know, some of the last few games, and I remember the concern at the beginning was the defense. Can he defend well enough to kind of justify the minutes that you want to plug him in there as a scorer? And, you know, that was kind of a question that I think was fair to raise, and it still will be fair to raise for a while. But when you look at his first 19 games as a pro, he was either a neutral or positive in only five of those first 19 in terms of plus minus. His last 20, he's been neutral or positive in 15 of the last 20. So I'm interested in that. You look at what he does in the last 7 seconds of the clock, which we know, you know, that's kind of an area where you look at that Spurs series, for instance, where the Nuggets just really struggle at times, where it's either Murray or Jokic, or, you know, it's kind of, you can't trust certain people. Gary Harris, we know, has struggled a ton. He's 14 of 27 in the last 7 seconds of the clock.
He can get buckets.
He can get buckets.
He's one of the most interesting young players for me in a while, because in the same 30 seconds of play, he can look like a little bit robotic, as if he doesn't feel the game and read the game in a natural way, and then make a cut or get in position for a rebound or get into a passing lane in a way that's like, oh, he saw that
because
fast.
He knows what he's looking for as far as getting a basket. And so, and I think what makes him so interesting, you get guys like that sometimes, maybe not at that level, maybe not a guy that had, you know, number one overall pick talent, but they don't end up on teams that are in contention this quickly. And that was what was so intriguing about him to begin with. And I think why so many of the Nuggets fans were frustrated that Michael Malone wasn't making a ton of time for him at the beginning. So he, to me, is really intriguing. You know, I think if Denver surprises people and makes a real run at the West in the postseason, I think that will be a big part of it. And what role he plays in it when stuff slows down for them and kind of grinds to a halt.
Well, we've already seen when Denver plays some of the bigger teams in the league, like the Lakers or this new Clippers team with Morris, I don't know if they played them yet, but this would be an example. They will play Torrey Craig a little bit more. They'll play. They have played little bits and pieces with Jeremy Grant, Paul Millsap, and Jokic all on the floor together because they want Grant to guard LeBron or Kawhi. I could see them going, you know, Torrey Craig at the three, and then Millsap Jokic or Grant Jokic, which means one of Harris and Barton goes away, and you start sort of playing with these lineup configurations, and okay, Torrey Craig's not really a shooter. No one's going to guard him. Very important playoff player for them last year. Guarded
Huge.
Lillard in the first,
yeah.
in the second round, rather. You know, and Gary Harris just hasn't been good enough. And so is he going to get squeezed? And then you remember, wait a second, there's this other guy who Michael Malone didn't trust for a long time, and the front office, I think, wanted to clear out some other guys, so Michael Malone had no choice but to trust him. And the theoretical version of that guy is big, at least has the size and athleticism to hang on defense. Like, he's got to overcome a lot of inexperience and youth and all the mistakes you make when you're young, but he at least has the baseline Like, you're not going to roll him off the court.
Right.
And has a nice stroke from three, can get buckets one-on-one, sort of checks a lot of these boxes, and you're like, boy, it just feels a little soon. Like, it feels like it might be far-fetched that Mike is really going to trust him in the playoffs. Right.
And that's the thing, is that last year, it's always a tough sell for me to think that a team that hasn't been in the playoffs before in year one is going to get it done. And so I think I picked them to win their first round series, but didn't pick them after that. So now they have a little bit of that experience, but now this will be his first go at that. And how much does Michael Malone trust him? How much does the speed of the game, you know, even though theoretically it's slowing down in the playoffs a little bit, but how much does the physicality kind of throw him off, if it does at all? But I'm interested to see it, because he's the sort of player with his talent, his skill set being what it is, who can really kind of shift a series in one direction or another.
Well, and one of the more fun plots of this last whatever games is Denver, Clippers, Jazz. Denver has 17 losses, Clippers 18, Jazz 18, Rockets 20. Then there's a little bit of a gap, two games between the Rockets and the Thunder and the Mavs. Let's just, 2-4 for now, that's a big deal in terms of who you face in the first round.
Yep.
Who has home court in the second round? Who's in whose bracket? Are the Lakers and the Clippers going to end up in there in a semifinal bracket instead of the conference finals that everyone is sort of dreaming about?
Right.
That's a big, big deal. And right now, Denver is 2, and their first round opponent would be Dallas at 7. Boy, that would be a hell of a first round series.
That's so crazy to think about.
And you know, we've seen Denver last year. There was some chicanery.
I forgot about that last
late season,
2 or 3 days, yeah,
chicanery, and everything fell right for them, and so they still have matchups. Like, I still don't think they'd be excited about facing Harden. That matchup still scares them.
Yeah.
So they were on my list too. Okay, since we overlapped, I will give you the ability to lead off with number two, another one of your five most interesting.
So we went through a little bit of this. You actually just explained it, and I think the way I went with these five actually says a lot about the way I view the league right now, because of how far ahead the Bucks are of everybody out east. Those teams that you talked about being bunched kind of in that anywhere from that 2-4 range are kind of the ones I focused on for a lot of these. So I'll go to the next one. Mike Conley is
2-2.
Oh Lord.
This is going to be a short podcast.
This is going to be a really short podcast. I had some extras on deck just in case. So.
Yeah, I got a lot of runners up. We could do who are the runners up. I'll tell you, can I go through some of my runners up?
Sure.
Because we're not going to talk about these people, so all their teams fans can be
mad. Our runners up are the same too, we're going to have to wear matching clothes.
All these people's teams can be mad that the national media is ignoring them because they're runners up. Spurs, Derek White and DeJounte Murray, will they play more together? Ignored. Marvin Bagley, if he ever plays, ignored. RJ Barrett, does he actually stink or is he actually good? He's shooting like 0%. Ignored. Karl Anthony Towns and D'Angelo Russell, we've already talked about them enough. Ignored. Victor Oladipo, it's too obvious. Ignored. Steph Curry, I'm excited, but we're ignoring him. Christian Wood, ignored.
That's a good one.
Sekou Doumbouya, you know who's on fire right now by his standards? Malik Monk. Off the list of runner-up.
You went really deep with this. So I think... like you said, your question about most interesting players going forward was open to interpretation. I guess I pretty much angled it in a postseason sort of conversation.
So that's fine. So give me your Conley, because Conley's on my list too. I have a lot of Conley notes. So start off why Conley's your pick.
So Conley's my pick because I don't know that you could kind of dream up a worse nightmare than kind of what he had in the first season, unless he had like a season-ending injury. That first half was pretty brutal, most of it, I'll say, because I came into the season thinking this. Conley is a worthwhile pickup for the Jazz, if only because of the fact that the last couple postseasons you've probably seen, at least at times, if not for entire postseasons, that Donovan Mitchell's not really ready to be that much of a number one option, that teams load up on him, that he's not always the most efficient. And so if you have another guy that can kind of take the ball handling pressure off of him, and not just him, but also Bogdanovich as well, that you really help him because you allow the defense not to load up on him as much. So
that was the idea.
That was the idea. And then lo and behold, Conley, what did he shoot? 1-14, 1-16 in his opener. with Utah was rough.
He's had a few where you look at the box score and you're like, is that a typo? What?
Yeah.
What happened?
And literally started his tenure there that way. And obviously that, the injuries. And so if anything, you know, what I thought and maybe what a lot of us thought going in is that, you know, he's going to help Donovan Mitchell. Mitchell actually got out to a really, really nice start, hot start, with Conley either not playing or not playing well at all. And so that went counter to what a lot of us were thinking. But, and this is true of one or two people on this list of the five most interesting players I've got, he started to kind of unthaw, kind of thaw out a little bit right as the All-Star break hit, which you never know if that's a good thing or a bad thing now that you've had a week off and kind of gotten away from the game a little bit. But, you know, he's been shooting better. He's kind of back to what his normal numbers would look like.
He's sneaky up to 36% on threes and 57% at the rim, which is
career numbers.
Yeah, which is what's not rebounded is the twos in between, which he takes a lot of.
And that's what I was going to point out. And I actually looked that up before I came over here. It's largely in his floaters, which is crazy. Like you said, kind of that 3 to 10 foot range. I looked at it. So since Second Spectrum has existed, Mike Conley, every year except for this one, had shot at least 5 points better percentage-wise than expected, than an average player would be expected to make on those shots.
Floater is his shot.
It's his shot.
The righty floater.
This year, he is about 4 points worse than the average player
and
would
I'll tell
be.
You
what, and it's 34%, which is just brutal.
I'll tell you what's worse than that, Chris Herring. The eye test on those shots, because he's missed a lot of them. Like, did he mean to hit the backboard?
Mm-hmm.
Like that? Ooh,
right.
A lot of like ones where like, is his vision okay? Like, is he just his depth perception has gone awry or mm-hmm. something? Because you're not used to Mike Conley just like wildly bonking these
it's
like
crazy.
Floaters that are like not. It's not as if there's like a 7-footer that's right in his face.
Right, and it's crazy you bring that up because you know, those are the sorts of things that we can never really know until a player tells us or until we hear that there's some sort of injury. He's had eye problems before.
And well, I just made that up.
No. But like he's had it before and even in that season wasn't struggling to this extent. So it's a really interesting sort of thing to look at. But again, you had encouraging signs, even in just the last week or two before the break, similar to, you know, having kind of encouraging signs of him and Mitchell together. And how those numbers look compared to the way they did for the first few months of the season. So, you know, I say all that to say this. I think most of us would assume that the Jazz aren't going to go too deep into the playoffs if Conley is just a total dud. And so you obviously want him and kind of need him to give you something. The fact that, you know, in the month of February, he's averaging 26-5 or 25-4 or whatever it is on numbers that are Conley-like numbers has to be encouraging and is something that I'm really curious to see for the rest of the season.
Some of that play encompassed a very bad 5-game losing streak for Utah, which included a loss to Denver when Denver had 7 players.
That
I think.
True. That was maybe their worst performance of the year.
And a loss to the Rockets where neither Russ or Harden played, which is – that's bad. So here's what's interesting to me. Utah has 3 kind of core lineups, all of which have gotten run as – the starters. One was the no Mike Conley lineup, which is Mitchell, Ingles, Royce O'Neal, Bojan Bogdanović, Rudy Gobert. That lineup is plus 17.5 per 100 possessions in 500 minutes. It's the 7th best margin of all lineups in the NBA that have played a minimum number of minutes. It's a great lineup. No Mike Conley in that lineup. Then you had their initial starting lineup, which was Joe Ingles comes off the bench. So that's Conley, Mitchell. So Conley's in this one. Conley, Mitchell, O'Neal, Bogdanović, Gobert. That's plus 14 per 100 possessions in 280 minutes. But then Ingles, but the Jazz were not playing very well. Ingles off the bench wasn't working. Then Ingles got put back in the starting lineup and was mm-hmm. balling out. And so, like, Ingles has to start. Then you land on their current starters, which is Royce O'Neal comes off the bench. Conley, Mitchell, Ingles, Bogdanović, Gobert. That lineup is plus 2 only for the overall neutral in 186 minutes. That's the worst of the three so far by far. Now, these are tiny, 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 teensy sample sizes other than the 518-minute one. But that's a long way of saying I don't think it should be set in stone, nor do I think if you give Quinn Snyder the proverbial truth serum that it is set in stone that Mike Conley is starting in the first game of the playoffs. I don't think that – I don't think – maybe it is and I'm wrong – But if I were the coach of the team, it wouldn't be set in stone. I would be using these last 25 games to see what my starting five should be. And like, yeah, you can stagger, you can stagger the minutes here and there, whatever, and all that.
Right.
You know, what's my crunch time five? And Quinn has settled on, I think, a temporary sort of way he wants to juggle his lineup, which we can talk about. But they're going to have to make a hard choice: who starts and who finishes. And Mike Conley has not made a case yet that he should be part of either one of those lineups. That's wow. like an ironclad case.
Well, let's say this. So you went through a couple of your ones that did not quite make your list. And I'm curious if this made your list, because this is one that I left off of mine, but it segues into the same point that we were just talking about with Conley and the idea that not really sure where he fits within the rotation if the playoffs start tomorrow. Did you put Horford on your list or anything with the Sixers?
No, I self-regulated. I banned myself from any Sixers content on this podcast.
Okay.
That's a real thing. That was my rule for myself. I meant to tell you that in an email. I'm not picking
any
Sixers.
You did not tell me that. Okay. So I left it off my list as well, but obviously that is a really interesting sort of thing, particularly in Horford's case when you consider the contract and the fact that he just went to the bench. But, yeah. So that was not on my list either. So
also very similar players, actually, in terms of personality, career, how far they've gotten in the playoffs, beloved among NBA nerds,
yep.
not flashy. They're kind of like similar
yep.
characters in the NBA lexicon.
Sure. Okay. Well, you gave me that one to list out. Conley was my pick. So what was your next one?
Well, no, I'm not done.
Excuse me?
With Mike Conley.
Are you going to punish him now?
No. So lately what Quinn has done is, when Conley's playing and they start that lineup that doesn't include Royce O'Neal, Conley and Ingles come out together in the middle of the first quarter. Clarkson, who's been very good for them, and I didn't love that trade for them.
That's worked out better than I thought it would.
He's been so good for them. It's hard to say. I still kind of don't love it. I feel like they have too many guys who want the ball and need the ball, but what can you do?
It kind of hurt my soul when they traded Exum for him, just because I've always said that I think I have more hope for guys that are mostly defense focused than offense focused, because I feel like you can find the offense focused guys more easily, and also feel like the defense focused guys can come around offensively a little bit more than people realize. But it's worked out better than I thought it would.
And Exum, I think, had like 28 points in one game for the Cavs and may not have 28 points combined since that game. And anyway, Clarkson and Royce O'Neal come in for Conley and Ingles. So they want to keep, I think, one of Mitchell and Ingles on the floor at all times. I think they should do that. They've risked more minutes than I would with both Mitchell and Ingles on the bench. And like, let's see if Conley, with some help from Clarkson, can carry those lineups. I would 86 those when it counts. So I just think they have, and Clarkson has played his way into like who should close games conversation. And some of it will depend on, do we need Royce O'Neal's defense or do we not? And that's a matchup thing. That's a score thing. Are we ahead? Are we behind? They have a lot of interesting choices to make. Okay, next we're going to go to my list.
Yep.
Because we've gone to your list. The number one player on my list, and I was ranking them, who am I most interested to watch? And I don't think he made yours because he's not on a playoff team. DeAndre Ayton.
He's not on my list. Okay. That's interesting. And he's been really interesting since he came back, even before the suspension, if you just want to look at one game sample sizes. But he's looked different than he was last year. There's no doubting that. And, I think the Suns have kind of faded in the conversation a little bit. I know they still have an outside chance at the last seed there in the West, but anything that they're dealing with is not really his fault. I'll put it that way. He's looked good.
They are 7 games out of the loss column, out of the red hot.
That far now?
Memphis. Well, the Grizzlies actually lost 2 games in a row, so they're not red hot. But overall, we'll give Memphis red hot. They're 28 and 26. That's red hot for them.
Yeah.
So Phoenix is toast. But I just think Ayton is like, because of the suspension, we are still really learning, like, what is this guy?
Yeah.
And this is the guy forever, for better or worse, that you took over Luka Doncic.
Mm-hmm.
When you had the head coach of the Slovenian national team as your coach.
That's the worst part.
And if Phoenix is going anywhere serious in the next 5 years, DeAndre Ayton has to be good. And I think this year has been, like, defensively, he's made significant strides. Now, he started off looking like he did not understand what was going on the court, and now
you mean when he got in the league?
When he got in the league,
sure, of course.
Now his at rim numbers are good. in terms of what teams shoot at the rim. Phoenix is with Ayton on the court, 112 points per 100 possessions, 108 allowed, so plus four. Off the court, 108 points, so their offense declines, 111 allowed. Their defense gets worse. All signs are good. Part of that is teams are shooting like some ridiculously low percentage on threes with Ayton on the floor. I'm not sure that he has anything to do with that.
Sure.
But he looks competent. I'm more interested in, like, what is this guy as an offensive player? Is he a pick-and-roll guy? Is he a post-up guy? Well, if he's a post-up guy, can he actually try to get to the rim? And he still gets, like, pushed off his spot sometimes by guys who are not as big as him. And what kind of pick-and-roll partnership is he going to develop with Devin Booker? Like, does he want to zip to the hoop and roll hard? Does he want to pop? I just think there's, like, a lot of different directions he can go as a player that are interesting to me. And a player that I think he reminds me of a lot as a rebounder only is Andre Drummond. I think he's an absolutely monster rebounder whose raw rebounding, whose defensive rebounding is a little bit empty calories. Like, he doesn't box out, and so he doesn't help your team defensive rebound as much, but his offensive rebounding is sensational. But offensively, Drummond has showed, other than maybe a season and a half when he was really passing from the elbows, he's shown, like, not that much of an all-around skill set.
I remember that season and a half, and I was so confused. I actually wrote about it at one
point. Ayton has a chance to go lots of different directions as an offensive player.
Yeah. And what's so interesting about that, too, because you focused on that part. For me, what's kind of been, I wouldn't say a revelation, I don't think it's been that strong. He's shown me more defensively this year than I thought he was capable. Because, like, really, when a lot of us critiqued, very early on the decision to draft him number one, and, you know, trying to get inside of Phoenix's head and why they did that. Is it to get a local guy and to fill seats? I didn't see much from him defensively last year. And, you know, a lot of people will tell you, well, you're being too hard on a first-year player at that position because they can kind of grow in leaps and bounds. But he's been a lot better just in kinds of positionally kind of looking like he knows what he's doing. He really eats bad defenses alive. And I think, like you said, still can be pushed off his spot, and I think that's kind of something that you learn a little bit more about, and you learn your positioning.
His post-up numbers are bad.
Yeah.
His post-up numbers are, like, not – I would say they're average to below average, which, given his volume and his apparent ambitions for being that kind of player, right, is bad.
But and part of that, when you really boil some of it down, you talk about boxing out, you talk about trying to post up, which when you're younger and when you're – at the college level and before that, the high school level, you can get away without having form and really knowing the fundamentals and having your feet in the right place. You can work on that stuff. I mean, posting up, I don't know, if Mike D'Antoni were still in Phoenix, I don't know that he would want him doing that. But he also has like a face-up game. He has a lot of things.
He's got good touch.
He's got a really good base to build off of. And the idea being that if you're this young and at this point in your career and you already do this number of things well, I think that's where you're going with this in terms of saying, like, he can go in a lot of different directions.
He's got good touch. He's a good passer. So if he draws double teams in the post, he's going to make the right read.
Right.
But you got to be outstanding in the post to make that a big part of your game. They have this, their lineup with him at center and Rubio, Booker, Oubre, Bridges. So a small ball lineup is killing people. It's plus a lot in 180 minutes. And he's a dynamic pick-and-roll player. Like, you put spacing around him and he dives to the rim, he draws a load of attention. He's athletic. He has incredible hands. He can catch and finish from all over the floor, including lob dunks. And he and Booker have a nice little partnership going. Now, Ayton, would it kill him to actually make some contact on a pick every once in a while and, like, hit somebody?
Right.
All he wants to do is be Amare and, like, slip to the rim. And that's cool, but sometimes you got to lay the wood on people, and he hasn't done that.
And it sounds like that's part of what you're saying, too, is just like he's not inclined to kind of be more physical, which, you know, if you can get the dirty work done without actually having to get dirty.
Well, he just wants to dunk.
Right.
He wants to get to the rim and dunk, which is fine. And like all of what's interesting to me about Ayton is we tend to put centers, because the center is such a tricky position in the modern NBA, right? Like, there's all these replacement level centers that you can get, and they do the job. And like the Celtics were like, Daniel Tice is fine. We don't need.
Well, look at the guy who replaced him. Look, I mean, you think about that. And
Baines.
Yeah. You just think about the idea that he's knocking the crap out of people on picks and how it was opening up their offense. And you and I talked the last time I was on your podcast, the last time we talked, we believe it or not, we're talking about, man, the Suns, if Baines is going to play this way, the Suns might have to kind of have an awkward decision to make about where, obviously you're not going to get rid of Ayton. I mean, that was never going to happen. You were never really going to just shun him. But the idea being that the Suns were, you know, looking like one of the better teams in the league for the first few weeks, partly because of the way that Baines was playing. And it was such a different style, just getting guys open. And you have to actually set screens to do that.
Oh, man.
Hit Baines, people to do it.
It hurts me watching on television when Baines smacks somebody with a pick. I could be wrong about this, and the Phoenix truthers will tell me now that I'm going to be wrong about it. I don't think Ayton is ever going to be special on defense. I don't think he's ever going to be all defense level special. Now, if that turns out to be wrong, then this is a whole different conversation. If he's just good, like if he's just, I don't know, who's like an okay defensive rim protectee set? If he's just like 90% of peak DeAndre Jordan, just like good. Like DeAndre Jordan, I think, made an all defensive team, but like no one ever thought he was special.
Except for Doc Rivers.
That is true. I believe a Bill Russell comparison was used at one point. I don't think he's ever going to be special. If he's not special, this is just the reality of being a center. If you're going to invest max money,
you've got to be damn good.
You have to be a crazy good offensive player.
Yeah.
So here are the ways you can be a crazy good offensive player as a center. You can be the greatest dive man in the history of the league. You can be what Andre Drummond should be. Just alley-oop, 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 alley-oop. Four guys have to converge on me. Do what Gobert does on offense. It's hard to be super-duper special that way, but like maybe. You can be Jokic and be just Arvydas Sabonis-level passer. You can be the greatest passing big man of all time. He's not going to be that. He's going to be good at it. Or you can be Embiid-y, where you can do a lot of everything and brutalize people. And like, I just don't know. He has the ability to sort of.
His post-game doesn't look like it's going to be.
But I think he's big. If he gets a little stronger and more physical, like he's huge. I think he has the ability to shape shift between all of those archetypes. And if he can do all of them pretty well, I think that adds up to a special offensive player.
That's a good one. Yeah.
And this last 25 games to me is, let's see sort of how he navigates that.
Sure.
What does he want to do? What does Phoenix want him to do?
That's a good one that I had not thought about, honestly. Yeah.
Give me your next guy.
Okay. Let me go east because most of mine are west. So I'll go for the one that I've got east, Brooke Lopez.
I don't have any Bucks? I have no Bucks.
So
no Bucks.
To me, I feel like Milwaukee rightfully so deserves to be talked about as obviously the favorite in the east, maybe the favorite to win the whole thing. They're at a point now where I think it's kind of more a question of like if they weren't to get to the promised land, what's holding them back? Brooke, obviously, you know, and I know there are some people that have been saying this, you know, that Brooke probably, and it's weird when you think about Gobert, he's kind of been so far ahead of the curve of most people defensively for the Defensive Player of the Year award. He has been the last few years. Brooke, I think, in a normal situation, actually probably would be in that conversation. He plays for the best team in the league. He has basically dominated the rim protection numbers.
You know what hurts his Defensive Player of the Year case, though? The fact that there's a better defensive player on his team who's also dominating the rim protection.
True. Now, that's true.
And also is probably going to win MVP.
And should win MVP. And so that's fair. And that will always happen. And I think that's kind of what I was going to get at is that the idea that normally, and I think maybe Gobert might be the lone exception for this, in order to get real buzz around Defense Player of the Year, unless you were just a crazy defender that has that reputation, it's kind of like the silver slugger in baseball. That a lot of times if you are a great hitter that you're going to get more attention for your defense if you're decent on defense. I think Brooke Lopez has been really, really, really good, maybe even great defensively this year.
Sensational. His timing on shot blocks, he has ballet dancer kind of feet.
And because of that, it sucks that he's had a really rough offensive year. Because I kind of feel like you said, you could make a very fair argument, just like Giannis was in the conversation last year for Defensive Player of the Year, that he's not maybe even the best defender on his team, but he's exceptional in his role. He is a top two or three rim protector this year. And really, to me, if I look at the things that, you know, if you told me the Bucks were not going to come out of the East, I could probably point to a couple things that might have to do with that. Maybe it's that Eric Bledsoe has another rough postseason. Maybe it's that Giannis kind of gets a little shy like he did last year when Kawhi kind of locked him up in the conference finals. But I would be concerned right now about Brook Lopez and his shooting. I'm
going to go the opposite way.
Okay.
I'm unconcerned.
You're unconcerned.
I'm unconcerned. So Brook Lopez is shooting 29.8% from three, I believe, because I looked it up today.
Is that overall?
I believe so. Okay. 30%. Let's just say 30%.
Okay.
Which is bad.
It's bad. And it's bad because he also – it's funny because when you said that number, it jumped out at me because I've got on my computer right here. 29.7% when left wide open this year, worst in the NBA.
So all his attempts are
because
wide
all open. His attempts are wide open. That's why it didn't look any different. But worst in the NBA when left wide open, and that's why it's a little concerning. But like I was saying about Conley, someone who heated up before the break a little bit, and so maybe he's kind of thawing out a little bit. Who knows? The All-Star break came at maybe a rough time for him because he was starting to shoot better. But why are you unconcerned?
First of all, is there any chance the Lopez brothers did not go to a Disney theme park for All-Star break? It's like 100% chance that they did.
They probably go during the season, too.
So I am unconcerned because, he's taken 1,500 career threes. So the sample size of him being a league average three-point shooter, which, by the way, that's all he was last year when everyone thought he was like big man.
No, it was just he was taking a bunch of them.
He was 36%.
Right.
Is not huge. So there's a chance that he's not that. There's a chance that he's not a league average three-point shooter.
Okay.
What I'm not concerned is that the rest of his game has remained equally effective, not just on defense. Yeah. Offensively, one of the underrated things about the Bucks and why Lopez is important for them is it's really hard to go small against the Bucks. Mm-hmm. Because if you just play one big, right, like small as we think, four perimeter players and a big. Well, the big, with very few exceptions, the big is now guarding Giannis because you cannot guard Giannis with a smaller player. If you put a smaller player on Giannis, that player is going into the basket or out of bounds as Giannis really rudely, frankly, dunks in his face. So then you put a small guy on Lopez, and Bud has been really smart this year and even smarter than last year about when teams do that. Brook starts posting up like it's 2012 again, and he mashes. You like the Sixers had Shake Milton on him a couple times, and he was like, "Oh, Shake Milton, the you're going to guard me with Shake Milton? It's 2012, baby. Shake Milton's going in the basket." And Brook is like a sneaky little pump and go driver. Like it's not even pump and go because he's so slow. Pump and kind of like, but it works, and he like gets layups, yeah. And he's a good passer. So I have faith that the jump shot is coming.
Okay.
I have faith that the three-point shot is coming.
That's my only
also,
fear,
interestingly,
man.
Everyone has been waiting and waiting and waiting for when are the Bucks going to pay for Brook Lopez sitting back in the paint on defense.
Yeah.
And they paid a little bit against Toronto. Kawhi hit some pull-up threes.
Sure.
Kyle hit some pull-up threes, but they were tough. Like, if players even that good are going to hit enough of those shots to beat you, you tip your
cap.
Well,
that was what happened in the Christmas Day game when they lose to the Sixers, is that the Sixers have – by far their best shooting day of the year. I think they hit 21 threes, and I think maybe the next closest game they've had all year was like 14 or 15. And so kind of an anomaly of a shooting night. Those things are going to happen, and I think the scary thing about that is, in the playoffs, it only takes one big shooting night to kind of completely shift your game plan.
This is why this is a big playoffs for Bud.
It's huge.
Because if you look at the history of Bud's teams – that have lost in the Atlanta teams and Milwaukee teams that had real ambitions of going places.
Sure.
A lot of their playoff series losses, I think the brain trust of those teams would chalk them up to, we shot badly on open looks and they shot great on open looks and what can you do? And I'm like, well, that's like awesome that, you're using this like big sample size math to explain, if we had played them 20 more times,
right,
the odds would have shifted. Guess what? You don't get to play them 20 more times.
Right.
They win four and the series is over and you go home and your guy has a supermax in front of them and it's all of a sudden the thing. Like, I think they have not been good enough at coming up with a plan B. And maybe they won't need a plan B this year. Maybe they're really this good.
I was concerned about it last year when they had the Celtics series. They got blasted in that game one. And they were playing against a big man in Horford.
And then the Celtics were like, we all hate each other. Let's just collapse.
But, they were playing against a big man in Horford who can hit that shot if you're just going to give it to him. So I mean, I think their defense, they've kind of sold out in terms of the way they play defensively. And again, that's why I think Lopez is so unique. I just think back to the series last year against Toronto where Mirotić was just so brutal. He could not hit anything.
I do remember them switching a little bit more mid-series.
And that Toronto series?
To adjust for what Toronto was doing. So, but that's fine. I just think if you are relying too much on the vagaries of shooting, this is why everyone's like the mid-range shot in the playoffs or the ability to draw fouls. All of this becomes more important because mm-hmm. the competition is so good.
Well, who do you have for your next one? So I had Lopez and just his shooting, a little bit concerned about it. But like you said, he's good enough on defense to where I don't think you're going to pull him out of a game if he's struggling to make shots. But I'm curious to hear your next one.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because they're deadly with Giannis at center, and they've leaned further into those lineups this year. But the other teams will go small against those lineups and try to survive, whereas like going small against their big lineups is you just functionally can't do it. It's one of the sort of underrated things about why they're so good. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a choice. The two remaining players that we have not hit on my list.
I bet we have one more in common, but I'm curious.
Marcus Morris, who I use as just a proxy for the Clippers.
okay, then we did not have that.
And problem. John Collins. So you can pick one of those to discuss.
Okay. Let's talk Collins because I kind of feel like the Clippers are easy enough to get into, and I'm sure we'll end up talking about them another time if we have to.
Okay. I picked John Collins for a very obvious reason. The Hawks have decided, as an organization, John Collins is not a center. We are going all in on John Collins as a power forward, or let's put it this way. We are going all in on acquiring centers who are not John Collins.
Right.
One of whom is like we had a little Dwayne Dedmon reunion going on. Dwayne Dedmon can shoot threes,
right.
So we can sort of invert the roles that way. Collins can be our screen and dive guy, and boy, is he good with Trae Young in the pick and roll.
Yep.
Woo! And Dedmon can spot up and shoot threes, and we'll mix it up the other way. But we just traded some stuff for Clint Capella, who can't shoot anywhere at all, and his only role is as a dive man. So John Collins is going to be standing in the corner a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you this, guy, I watch film, so I know it's true. John Collins doesn't look super psyched to be standing in the corner when Trae Young dribbles around and does the Trae Young show for a little while and other people get to screen and dive for him. You see a lot of John Collins, you know, hands up like, hey, hey, I'm over here. I average like 20 a game. And then the shoulders slump a little bit. And like, look, that I don't think that's like the happiest version of John Collins. And there are ways to get involved as a, you can be the second screen setter on the second side action, or you can, you know, call for the ball in a mismatch in the post, and John Collins' post-up numbers are actually quite good this year in a limited sample. But this dude is extension eligible after the season.
That is interesting, yeah.
I am 100% sure that he and his representation conceive of himself as a star, and I would be surprised if their first offer was not, oh, the max. Give us the max. And the Hawks have built in some complexity to his life now. So that's why he's on my list.
That's fascinating, and I hadn't thought about that I hadn't really thought about guys that are extension eligible and kind of how some of this stuff factors in. It does make them really interesting, and you're right. And it's funny when you talk about some of that stuff. One of my bigger questions for the next 5-10 years is just how do you build around Trae Young? I mean, that is the question that Atlanta has to answer.
It's because this trickles down to not only if Collins is a four, well, you just drafted Reddish and Hunter.
Right.
And Hunter profiles as someone who can play the four. And actually, your lineup of your all-kids lineup of Young, Herter, those two wings, and Collins has been all right this year. But you've decided John Collins can't defend well enough to play the five.
That's exactly what you said.
And it trickles down to all of these other guys. And, you know, I thought, you know, okay, so if Collins – what you do with these fives, smaller fives, like Julius Randle is like this, if you can't protect the rim – then you can, let's try switching. Let's build a defense that can switch everything. And the Lakers did this a little bit with Randle. Because you're quick, can stay in front of some guards. You can't switch Trae Young anywhere.
Exactly.
You can't switch Trae Young onto like an oak tree. The oak tree will, he'll like fall over and run into it and collapse. You can't switch Trae Young, like you switch Trae Young onto Fred Van Vliet. Fred Van Vliet's going in the post and like bullying Trae Young.
And that's the thing is we just haven't, you know, the Steph comparison is cute enough. It has been cute enough at times. But Steph, I mean, I think we're doing Steph a disservice to say that Steph was that bad on defense. And I know that he had limitations. I know that that was a big part of Kerr's job when he came in was to say, look, you've got to kind of step it up and just guard, you know, because Mark Jackson was essentially kind of giving him a way out to let other guys handle the point guards and stuff like that. Trey is a solid step behind where Steph was at that time, I think.
Trae Young is the worst defensive player in the NBA. Let's not mince words.
Right.
He's the worst defensive player in the NBA.
And so trying to build around that, like, it's very clear he's fun. It's very clear that he's a good offensive, you know, the potential to be a great offensive player. No one's doubting that, but it doesn't change the fact that it's really hard to build around someone that you conceive of as a franchise player when he can't play the other side of the ball.
Now,
and it's not an effort thing. It's not, well, sometimes it is an effort thing. As soon as I said that, I realized I don't want to give him that much of a way out, but it sometimes it's an effort thing. But even if you were giving full effort, I'm not sure that he would be even, I can't ever see him being an average defender.
Well, Steph gives full effort and I can hear the Atlanta fans saying, well, wait a second. The Warriors won championships with switching defensive schemes and teams that went at Steph in mismatches.
There were a lot of things they had.
What they had was literally Hall of Fame level defenders all over the floor.
Exactly. Smart guys, too.
And, you know,
IQs.
Reddish and Hunter have the bodies of that. We'll see how, and certainly Hunter, I believe, was the NCAA Defensive Player of the Year or something. He got some award for the whatever scheme the NCAA is running, you know, you got in that fake professional league, he got some award. Who knows? But I just think Collins, it's an easy solution to make. Okay, he's not a five. He can't defend five, right. So we'll make him a four. Defending fours is really hard. You ever watch Julius Randle, and I hate to keep invoking his name, like try to rotate in off a small ball four who can shoot threes, like rotate into the paint, rotate back out, keep track of everything. Like it doesn't.
Unfortunately, I have seen that before.
It doesn't go super well.
No, it doesn't. So that was your fourth one? No, you gave your last two.
I don't know.
I've got two more.
Pick one.
Burn through them. So we can – one that I mentioned just because I think it'll be interesting, but we don't have to discuss it because there's nothing to analyze, in my opinion, just yet. Nurkic is going to be one of those guys.
He was around my runner-up.
Okay.
Runners-up.
So Nurkic will be interesting. I think it kind of creates a domino effect in terms of some decisions that have to come this summer for Whiteside. Whiteside, depending on what you look at.
Here's the decision. Whiteside does not play for my team next year.
And I think a lot of people would make that decision. But also, Nurkic will provide a lot of hope for the Portland fans, but I don't think when you talk about what value he adds, obviously he's a very good offense player. He's solid defensively. I don't know how much I would expect from him coming back from an injury like that. So that's interesting.
No, this year is gone. I mean, I shouldn't say that because they are within hailing distance of their ninth and their five games.
I mean,
they're column,
one of two teams I think they could realistically catch, mostly because Memphis has the toughest schedule in the league left. So, I mean, it's interesting. I also think Dame could kind of single-handedly, if he goes on another run like the one he just came off of.
I can't take another run like that.
Heart palpitations.
Oh, my God.
The other team player, whatever you want to say, that I had on my list was Westbrook I've kind of wondered for a while, a lot of us probably had, what if this dude just stopped jacking shots? What if he just stopped taking threes that are horrible, that have no chance of going in? And that's essentially what he's done now for a month. And the guy is now shooting, I think, 54-55%. Over that span because the last year I covered the Knicks, Derrick Rose did the same thing where he basically said he was a free agent at the time, Derrick Rose. So I think that was probably why he stopped shooting them. So you realized, you know, missed shots were costing him money potentially. But Russ essentially stopped doing that. And it's interesting because now with the lineups they're playing probably has even more space in the paint to just drive and kind of take advantage of things. But I also wonder on some level, with the way they're playing now, Russ has, you know, kind of these open lanes to go through and is taking advantage of it. P.J. Tucker might not have knees left by the time this is over.
I think P.J. Tucker can play forever. The evidence suggests P.J. Tucker never gets tired. He can play forever.
I feel like if we ran the data on that, Zach, at 538, that might not be true.
Well, I don't want to hear your boring data.
Just made me a blog boy.
So I self-regulated with the Rockets too. There's no Rockets talk for me on this podcast. I've talked too much. The Rockets and the Sixers are like I just spend too much time thinking about them.
Fair enough.
I said this last week and I'll say it again. This is my favorite version of Russell Westbrook ever.
This
one who doesn't shoot threes, who plays in wide open space.
I wonder why.
And just goes to the rim all the time. It's my favorite Russell.
And has another ball handler to take the pressure. I mean, obviously, Harden is more than just someone that takes the pressure off you.
I've been asked a lot of times about the Rockets in the last 2 weeks since they started playing super-duper small ball and perverting basketball. I say that sarcastically. I don't particularly right. feel any strong way about it.
Yeah.
And I have the most boring answer, which is like, I think they're just about as good as they were with Capella. Like, I don't trust their defense still
yep.
to be quite good enough. I think it's okay.
Yep.
And I don't think they're as good as the Clippers and the Lakers, and they have a puncher's chance against them in a playoff series. Nuggets, Jazz, I think those teams over 82 games are better than the Rockets in a playoff series. I don't know. Like, I sure. I kind of just think the same about the Rockets as I did before. I don't feel moved, really.
Let me ask you about – this is the – basically, the last team I have most. I had one or two other ones. I had Rondo and Zion as kind of like the other two guys that I was going to.
I can't talk. No Rondo.
That's fine.
Zion is.
Whew.
Is just insane.
I'm just blown away by the guy's touch around the rim when he's not dunking because I feel like the dunking gets so much attention. That guy just has like incredible touch. And
their
skill.
Numbers with Zion on the court are ridiculous.
Of course they are.
They're like hilarious for the guy's not in shape. He just started playing and he has the highest
that
plus minus on the team
fun.
For the season already.
That dude's like, going to be fun. So the one other thing, I can't think of a time you made them off limits as far as discussing. I feel like you discuss them more than normal for most teams. I think seeing what Toronto is like, and I know Boston fans will probably say we haven't been healthy either, what Toronto is like when they're completely healthy, because they're interesting from the standpoint that they have absolutely dominated bad teams. I think they're 31-2. Maybe I think they lost that last game before the break, so maybe they're 31-3 against teams that are under 500. But they've been arguably more banged up than anybody else in the league. Six of their top seven rotation guys have missed 10 games or more. And basically, they're one of the few teams that are in the conversation for a top five seed in either conference that doesn't have a winning record against 500 teams. So I look at that and I say, on the one hand, well, they're not playing all that great against the best teams, but they also haven't been anywhere near healthy. And that's included literally every key guy on their roster.
Literally.
Yeah. I think the only guy that hasn't is Anunoby, and I think he missed a game somewhere too. So I look at it. I look at how well Serge is shooting from three. This year, a career year for him.
Serge has had an unheralded great season.
He has. And I feel like everything about them has kind of flown under the radar because so many people, we didn't at 538. I know you didn't. And I don't think anyone wrote them off from the standpoint of like being a playoff team. But I said early on, it wouldn't have shocked me if they finished in the top three in the East. I didn't see two happening.
I wasn't there. If you told me they were going to be 40-15, that's their record.
Right.
Now.
Nobody saw that coming pre-All-Star break. And I actually had a story about them right before the All-Star break saying the Raptors weren't supposed to be as good. And, of course, I had a couple Raptors fans saying, oh, that was just you. I said, please, nobody had them at 40. We had them at 47 wins maybe in 538 for this season. So to have them at 40 before the break is nuts, and a 15-game win streak without having guys healthy. So I'm just curious, do you think that they would have even a puncher's chance at Milwaukee? Obviously, there's no Kawhi there anymore, but they do have a lot of those same parts from there. They don't have Danny Green either. Is there any chance with that team at full strength, with Nick Nurse being the coach he is? I think he's got a very good argument for coach of the year.
That Nick Nurse changed his starting lineup at halftime of the All-Star game.
Did it in the middle of the finals.
Yeah, but my point is, it's the All-Star game, and he's like, "Oh, I think it feels like we should probably start a couple different players."
Man, that dude is not afraid to try anything just to do it. I love that dude. The dude is such an incredible.
If I were coaching the All-Star game, I might accidentally start seven players. Like, that's how little I would care. I might like accidentally start guys who weren't on the roster.
Which team was that put six guys on the court a few weeks ago?
The Sixers.
The Sixers. There you go.
So I like this idea of a Milwaukee threat level. Like, who are the
That's
threats?
That's the only way you can pitch it. They're like seven games up on everybody.
So I'm going to go through Indiana, no, zero threat to Milwaukee. Okay. Sorry, Pacers fans. Philly is my big wild card. Like, theoretically, yes, they are a threat to Milwaukee. However, they are a threat to trip over their own feet and fall on their face and get swept in the first round because they're just a complete
bad road team too.
The
farther they fall back in the standings makes me worry.
So I picked Philly to make the finals. I think they in theory are a threat in that particular head-to-head matchup, but they're also a threat to like go down 2-0 against the Raptors and melt in a sweep.
So they were what a lot of people saw as Boston up until, I think even as the playoff started, you said it's not going to be Boston. Before that, I think you said, but they were kind of like last year's Boston.
The two teams that have impressed me the most in the East, and I think match up relatively well with Milwaukee, are Boston and Toronto. The Heat have an incredible record. I think the Heat are 8-3 against the other top five teams in the East and have a win in Milwaukee. A really good win in Milwaukee. I can't quite get there on the Heat. Yeah. I don't think they're as good as their record. I think they're really good. I think their aggression at the trade deadline was a very smart understanding of their own limitations as a team.
Were you surprised that they gave Iguodala 2 years?
They gave him only the one, but because the other one's a team option, so they might as well not have given him anything. Had they given him two, yes, I would have been surprised.
Okay. I didn't understand that part. I didn't realize that part of it. Okay.
Boston and Toronto have been just so impressive, and they have the right kind of rangy, switchable, multi-threat kind of guys to at least have a puncher's chance in that matchup. I think Boston is more talented, has more top-end talent than Toronto.
I do too, just at least a little bit more.
And by the way, I picked Brown over Tatum for the All-Star game, which I did that a month ago, and I took a lot of grief from Celtics fans. If you look at the shooting numbers a month ago, it wasn't close. What I also wrote in that piece was I would bet money that Tatum has a better rest of the season than Brown and has a better career than Brown. And Tatum, since the minute I hit publish on that column, has made not even a mini leap, a leap, capital L leap.
That last game he played before the break was insane.
I've been so impressed by Toronto and Boston. And what Toronto has that none of these other teams have is just this collective self-belief and will. They don't fear anybody. They don't care that Kawhi left. So I think both of those teams would give Milwaukee an interesting, a puncher's chance kind of series at least. And if you told me like, hey, you steal the first couple games and all of a sudden it's game seven in Milwaukee, like I don't think that's particularly shocking.
Yeah.
I think Milwaukee has no problem with Indiana, minor to no problems with Miami despite the head-to-head stuff. And Philly is just, you could tell me Philly goes 16-0 in the playoffs and wins the championship or goes 0-4. I'd be like, yes, fine, sure. I get it. You know, Ben Simmons, I have no idea.
Strangest team in the NBA this year, you think?
Strangest team in the NBA. I mean, it's hard to ignore 9-19 on the road. I mean, every second of the existence of the Chicago Bulls is strange by definition.
Oh boy.
Every second of it's
like
they're
player by player stripping away like the last thing that makes them worthwhile. Chris Dunn looks like he's going to miss basically the rest of the season now too, and it's just not that he was a reason by himself
to
watch them.
Strangest team. I mean, the Kings would be in the conversation for me. Starting 0-5, Buddy Hield's coming off the bench now.
Yeah.
All of that. And the Rockets are just strange all the time. But the Sixers are certainly.
Sixers are strange in a way where it's like if they don't get out of the first round somehow this year, that it feels like their change is coming.
DEFCON 1.
Yeah. So maybe that's what I don't know. Strangest, and obviously the exercise that we're doing today was most interesting. All this stuff is open to interpretation, but I think this was at least a good perspective on a lot of it.
My last one was Marcus Morris, only because I think he's played two games for the Clippers or three now.
Okay.
I like that trade for them. He's way better than Mo Harkless. Way, way, way better. Mo Harkless is a nice player. Marcus Morris is good.
Yeah.
You put Kawhi, PG, and Marcus Morris out there at 2-3-4. With a big and a point guard or a Lou Williams, whatever. Lou's just a Lou. Lou doesn't have a position. He's just a Lou. You put those 3-2-3-4 on defense, they can switch everything. On offense, an accomplished post player or one-on-one player is going to have a mismatch every single time the Clippers have the ball.
That's one way to think about it, yeah.
The danger that has already manifested itself a little bit in those first three games is Marcus Morris will get the ball and stop it and do his little dance and jab step and post
which
up.
Was okay to do in New York.
Yeah, I'm like, Marcus Morris, man, look at those two other dudes.
Yeah.
Like, they're way better than
that's
you.
Part of what you get with him, though, is that just this dog mentality that, like, he's the best player out there. And I think a lot of NBA players get to the place that they get by having that mentality. But it is interesting to go from a total losing situation to jump into something where, you know, I know in our model at 538, they're the favorite now.
I think they're so deep that So if you assume their closing lineup when it's go time is those three dudes and Harrell and pick a guard, right? That means only one of the following players gets to see the floor. Yeah. Lou Williams, Landry Shamet, who's good, Patrick Beverley, who's good, Reggie Jackson, who people think is good, who is not good and should not play very much. And have I missed another guard? I mean, like,
but can we circle back to that? Because that's what I was curious about. It's people have made such a big deal about the trade deadline. I get it. It's part of what we have to do at this time of year. The same with these buyouts and these signings. I looked at that one and I said, okay, that's a nice signing. He's a very nice backup guard to have. And I feel like in a lot of ways, what I like most about it is just that they stopped the Lakers from getting him. Because if he is potentially taking minutes or a role away from Lou Williams, I don't want the ball in Reggie Jackson's hands when I think about that offense.
So people look at Reggie Jackson, people who have not watched 1 second of Detroit Pistons basketball, right, which good for you. You've been doing more productive things into your life than I have. So I can tell I can tell you a lot about Bruce Brown's game. People look at Reggie Jackson, oh, that guy was on the Thunder. He's like pretty tough defensively. He can run the point, can shoot. All right, so here's what Reggie Jackson is. He stinks defensively. And he's not good enough with the ball to take it out of Lou Williams' hands.
That's the thing.
He's not any better of a spot-up shooter than Patrick Beverley. He's not in the same universe as a shooter as Landry Shamet. He's worse defensively than Shamet. He's probably better than Lou. Apologies to Lou, but that ain't saying much. And he's not better enough to take Lou Williams out of a game. And I just don't know what he's bringing to this team.
Right.
That is really all that meaningful. But, there'll be a quarter, I guess, when they get in trouble and Doc Rivers is like, let's just play the Reggie card and see what happens. And he'll do some stuff.
Again, I viewed it as something where I don't want him taking the ball out of Lou's hands at all. And if anything, I view it maybe if someone gets hurt or, again, you know, I think he's good enough to the point where he might develop, he might be enough of an upgrade for the Lakers to where it helps them. And so if you stop them from getting him, maybe it helps you, but I just think, I don't know, I think we have to fill time in the sense that the All-Star break just happened, there's no basketball. Oh, look, there's a signing. Oh, wow, the Clippers got Reggie Jackson. I didn't react that way just because I was just kind of like, I don't know. I look for the context of how someone fits a roster, and he doesn't really seem like an ideal fit to me, but it makes me feel better to know that you kind of think that too.
There is this is actually a very interesting debate within the league of do the Clippers need a traditional floor general to organize their offense? Are they, because Lou is I think actually an underrated passer, but he's not a traditional floor general.
Not at all.
Kawhi's passing has made a big uptick this season, but he's not a traditional floor general. Paul George is a great second option. He's not a traditional floor.
Beverly's really not either.
Yeah, Beverly's
because he's not really creating a whole lot into the paint or anything like that.
Yeah, Beverly's not a, let's run 50 pick and rolls with Pat Beverly.
He's always played off the ball, basically. Yeah.
I have come on that debate. I have leaned more towards this is much ado about nothing. That between Lou and Kawhi, who's an ideal playoff closer, PG and all that, like they got enough. That piece is not super interesting to me. I think as an organization, they've had a pretty healthy debate about that and concluded, like, why not? Maybe we'll get that guy. I just don't think he answers a lot of questions for them. It's not a particularly interesting signing to me. Yeah. Marcus Morris, the one way it is interesting is if they ever draw the Rockets, they are better equipped, I think, than any team in the West to play no big men and say, okay, you're little pocket Rockets. You're playing five smalls, five perimeter guys. We're going to do that too. And we're going to do it better than you.
Yeah.
Because our lineup is going to be Morris, Leonard, George, and pick two of those guards, and we're going to beat you at your own game.
Yeah.
And that's one conversation Reggie Jackson can butt his way into more easily if you're not playing either Zubats or Harrell at all.
And now it's more a question of who your wing guys are. Yeah, I hear.
But I think with Morris on board, if they can find the right balance in his game between being the Marcus Morris he wants to be and the one they need him to be, that becomes a really good, like the fully actualized version of that team is really good and tailor-made for slow down, nasty, mean playoff basketball. I just don't need to see Marcus Morris taking like 7 step back twos in any of these games. That's all.
Yeah, and a lot of times I wouldn't even say it was the best shot the Knicks could get, but who was going to tell him he couldn't do it with how the Knicks were playing? And so that's the thing, you know, and I think that's kind of an underrated part of the trade deadline is winning basketball.
With Steve Stout. That was who was going to tell
him. This dude was all up and down the sideline at the All-Star game against Chicago.
Stop. I can't. Okay, Chris Herring writes for 538. What do you have coming out soon? What should we be on the lookout for?
Nothing big, man. Just
what's your most recent one?
Most recent one was the one, I think, on the Raptors right before the break, just kind of on how they're doing all this stuff and how they're not only surviving but kind of thriving in this Eastern Conference that we didn't think that they'd be thriving in.
Chris Herring, everything you write is fantastic. It's always a pleasure when you come visit us on the Low Post podcast. Everybody likes it. Thank you for coming here, and enjoy the last 25 games of the season, my friend.
I appreciate you, man. Thanks so much for having me on, as always.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.